No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype us at BBS Radio 1. That's BBSRADIOONE. We have no guests today, just me and Maria. In fact, Maria's missing in action. We're trying to hook up with her right now, but she should be on any minute. So we're just going to shoot the breeze and talk about what's important and what's been going on lately. And we hope you'll call in with your questions and comments. Again, the number is 888-627-6008. And we're trying to reach Maria right now. But until we get her, let me continue on here and tell you what's going on with DC Statehood this week. We have no new sponsors of the new Columbia Admission Act. So it was of course, Congress wasn't in. They're in recess right now, were in recess, and for the Thanksgiving holiday. So we stand at 127 co-sponsors in the House and 18 in the Senate, which is more than we've ever had before. And in addition to that, the Washington Post did a survey this week that showed that 71% of registered voters in the District of Columbia want statehood for D.C. Yay! This is a record number of D.C. voters who support D.C. statehood. If you know about the issue, you understand that there are other things that can be done to remedy our situation. Retrocession, we could pass a law, we could do a constitutional amendment. All these things have been tried, none except retrocession. None of them have really worked, and retrocession is very difficult. It would mean going back to Maryland, and Maryland would have to agree to it, and they've actually talked about it and decided that they're not interested, so it's really a non-starter. Nonetheless, these things have been out there for years, and we've tried many, many different approaches, and statehood is what voters decided on in the 1980s, but we've never had 71% of registered voters in favor of DC statehood. So this is a big deal for us, and we hope to build on this. Tomorrow, our delegation, which you may remember, has just become a member of UNPO, which is Underrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, an international organization that goes before the UN and also before the European Union, giving us an international stage to discuss our grievances. In addition to that, tomorrow we go meet with the OAS, the Organization of American States, and that's a big deal too. So we're trying to get things on an international scale so that we can bring pressure on our government to finally recognize the 675,000 good citizens of the District of Columbia and make them equal. Our belief is that equality is a prerequisite of democracy, and until we have it in the District of Columbia, we won't have democracy. Is Maria with us yet, Don? Do we have Maria? I guess we do not. Okay, I guess not. So I guess I'll just have to prattle on, and maybe Don will think of some brilliant things that he can interject from time to time. Feel free to call in and help me prattle on. But let's start by continuing where we left off last week with Godfrey Harris. If you listened to our show last week, you heard Mr. Harris talk about the situation in Paris. He talked about how we got to where we are with the terrorists, with groups like ISIS. He believes that it was an outgrowth of our policy under the Bush administration, where we invaded Iraq and replaced all the hierarchy in the Iraqi government, thereby giving them impetus to support terrorism. And he thinks that's really what happened. And I think it was a very interesting perspective. He compared it to what went on when we tried to remove Noriega from power. I think it was a very, very interesting analysis, and it gave us a really interesting perspective. But the one thing that we weren't very clear on, because we didn't have enough time to cover it all, was what are our next steps? What do we do now? Do we join with the Russians as our allies in the region? Many people say that's a dangerous idea. If you have any comments on that, I'd love to hear from people, to hear what they think. We have not, since the Cold War, traditionally been allies with the Russians. We just last week had a NATO ally, Turkey, shoot down a Russian airliner. Shoot down a military plane. And also, it seems like they summarily executed the pilot when he ejected safely. So there's a lot of tension there. There's a different agenda. We have a common enemy, no doubt, in ISIS. They not only attacked Paris, but they brought down a Russian airliner, as you probably know, with more than 200 innocent civilians on it. So we certainly have a common enemy here with ISIS. But should we go down the path with hand in hand with the Soviet Union? My basic feeling about it is we should, but that we should be very, very careful about that alliance. But if you have an opinion, please feel free to call in. Also in the news, as far as the attack on Paris and terrorism goes, and ISIS in general, John McCain and Lindsey Graham have called for doubling the troops in Iraq to 20,000 and putting 20,000 troops in Syria. This is another really, really, I don't know how exactly to express it, but I think it's a dangerous move. And although I'm not against it necessarily, I think we need to be very cautious about it. We certainly have a different agenda with Assad than the Russians have. We also have a different agenda overall in the area. So I think, you know, after we finally started to get troops out of Iraq, putting 10,000 more troops in digs us in deeper, puts us back in the old quagmire that we've just extricated ourselves from. And I think it's very, very testy move. I don't know what to say. I wouldn't call it dangerous, but I think it's fraught with peril, and we need to be very careful. In addition to that, we have a discussion of Syrian refugees. We know that the president wants to let 10,000 Syrian refugees into the country, and that there's been a frenzy whipped up by Donald Trump and some of the other candidates, Ben Carson, on the Republican side of things, saying that Obama wants to let in hundreds of thousands of Syrians without vetting them, without proper documentation. And that's ridiculous. That's not what he wants to do. But that is also an issue that's been prominent in the press. And we have to decide on this. And so if you have an opinion on it, please call in. Please let us know what's up with your thinking on this, because this is a tough situation. We need to do something with these refugees. We can't just let them hang out there. And it seems to me that the president has a reasonable approach, but it also seems to me that people are very excited about this, and that they're whipping guys like Donald Trump are whipping people up into a frenzy, and I think it's terrible. Since we've actually used the T word, let's talk about Don Trump. He's really, really gone over the edge, I think. I got to tell you. I know his popularity is slipping. He's down in the polls several points, a double-digit drop over the last week. But, you know, he's still hanging tough. And most of us in politics thought that he'd be out by now. He'd be long out by now. We were saying August or September, he won't make it that far. But here we are. About to start. December 1st is on Tuesday, and he's still hanging in there. And he's doing it with the most base style of politics. It's really, really the oldest form of politics. It's racist, and it's incendiary. And for some reason, it always seems to happen on the Republican side of things. Which I find very troubling. You know, I haven't seen rhetoric like this. I haven't heard rhetoric like this since the time of Joseph McCarthy. I wasn't around when McCarthy was spewing his hate. I might have been around, but I wasn't aware. But this sounds much like the same kind of rhetoric he used, and rhetoric that I've heard many, many times during the civil rights era in the 1960s and 70s, and we really need to stop it. I hope that the Republican Party will stand up and say something about this man. They're being so sheepish about this. It's terrible. They're trying to get him out because they know what a problem he is, but they won't take a stand against him. Even on this crazy, crazy story that he's come up with, that thousands of people were standing in the state of New Jersey cheering when those buildings fell, when the Trump Towers fell, and the Republicans won't take a stand against that. The only one that said anything about it is Rubio. Christie from New Jersey said he doesn't know. You know, he never heard that happen, or does he doesn't have any firsthand knowledge of that, but it could have. He doesn't know everything. Carson first said, he saw the films too. He saw exactly what Donald Trump saw, but then he recanted that and said that he may have been talking about film news footage that he had seen from the Middle East. So, you know, we have to stop this terrible rhetoric, and because it doesn't do any good. It only makes us more divisive, especially in an age where we have movements in this country like Black Lives Matter. You know, we're already at a racially charged moment in our recent history, and we really don't need xenophobia to add to this. Donald Trump is just an embarrassment. You know, he's the kind of person that makes me embarrassed to be a politician. If you have a feeling about him, especially if you support him, please call in, because I'd like to talk to you. While we're talking about things on the Republican presidential campaign, we should also mention that Ben Carson dropped a little in the polls as well. And Governor Christie got a major endorsement from the New Hampshire Union newspaper. This is about as big as it gets in New Hampshire. Here we thought that he was gasping for breath. I think his campaign was gasping for air. It was pretty much in pretty bad shape. And, you know, here he gets this big, big endorsement. So, you know, who knows how this is going to pan out. But we still have a belief that Donald Trump will not be at the head of the pack when all this settles. And, you know, I think that his recent threat to the Republican Party that he may, in fact, run as an independent, he certainly indicated that that's a possibility. I think this has really scared the Republicans, because they understand that he'll take enough of the vote to be dangerous. And these fringe candidates do this all the time, and it's really the only power they have. So I really think Trump will run as a third-party candidate, and that's really why they need to stand up and get up to the, you know, be stand-up guys now and renounce them, because they're going to have to deal with them sooner or later. We certainly saw this on the liberal side of things. We certainly saw this why can't I remember his name? I'm getting so old. The advocate that ran against took enough away from Gore that Gore lost the election because he wouldn't withdraw from the race. And Trump is certainly a much stronger candidate than the guy that got rid of the Corvair, whose name escapes me right now. But you know, he was a thorn in our side during the first Gore election, and or in the Gore election where Bush won. And you know, Christie is going to really haunt the Republican Party. So it's time for these guys to stand up. And I'm sorry, not Christie, but Trump is really going to haunt these guys as an independent. And it's time for them to step up to the plate and stand up to him. And the guy I was thinking of was Ralph Nader, by the way. Ralph Nader,
right.
Took
That's
enough
correct.
Of the vote. He really didn't need to take much, but that little bit that he took really cost us the election. And this happens over and over again with these guys that are on the fringe. Nader knew he wasn't going to win. He knew he didn't have a shot in hell. I think he did better with his 2-3% than the polls said he was going to do. But yet he hung into the bitter end because he wanted to be a player. And in so doing, he just got, you know, really socked it to the Democrat. And Gore, we all know, lost by such a slim margin, and these guys better take a note from that. So tell me, Don, who are you going to vote for?
Well, that's a great question. Unfortunately, I can't vote. I'm Canadian. So what?
You're Canadian.
Yeah, I'm still Canadian. I moved to the States in 1977, but never got my U.S. citizenship, although everybody in my family did. And I was 9 years old, and they asked me at the time. I said, no, I just want to, you know, remain Canadian. And I was the only one in the family to do so. Even my twin brother's U.S. citizen.
Well, I got to tell you, I've been to Canada many times, and I really can't blame you. They're really, really nice people.
Well, you know, I think it was just a matter of being different than my twin brother at the time. That was really the deal.
No, I get that. You know, and I think we all make those original choices, you know, based on things like that. I've been a registered voter since I was 18, and people say, why are you a Democrat? And I could tell them why I'm a Democrat today. But when I was 18, I was a Democrat because my parents were Republicans.
Right.
And I figured, you know what? If they're Republicans, there's got to be something wrong with those guys, you know? So I'll be a Democrat. I mean, if they were, if they were libertarians, maybe I would have been a communist. I don't know. But, you know, that's all the thought I put into it, in those days. Let me ask you a question now that we're on the subject.
Sure. Who would I vote for?
there's an issue here in Washington, mm-hmm. and it's been they've done this in other places, but they want to let 16-year-olds vote. What do you think of that?
You know, that I think that's similar to what's going on now, bringing in a lot of people from other countries that haven't yet been here and earned that right, I don't think. And same thing with these younger kids. They haven't earned that right. They're too young. They haven't quite got the wherewithal to vote yet. They don't have a head for politics at that age, and why should they? And then to allow them to make those sorts of decisions would be tough for me. I would want them to be a little older and more qualified to make those decisions. I would like, you know, that on a larger scale, actually. So,
well, you know, I've got to agree with you. First of all, I've just my 16-year-old has turned 17 years old, but I remember, you know, I had three of them, and I'm sorry, I've got a little bit of a problem with letting a guy vote that I have to tell to take out the trash
right.
15 times, and he still doesn't, you know. And finally he turns around and screams at me, "Dad, get off my back." And then when he leaves an hour later, I go, "The trash is still there," you know. So it's a little hard for me to, you know, give the power of the vote to this guy.
Right.
Now he has the power of the vote since he's 20 years old, but but at 16, I don't know. I had a hard time giving up the keys to the car, let alone.
It's making people too responsible too quick. Again, it's destroying the innocence of our nation, of our youth, of our cultures, really. I mean, that's a little out there, but really it's the destruction of that innocence I'm so against. And whenever I see that, I'm against it. And this would be in that camp, so to speak. I don't feel comfortable with doing that to our younger generation. I'm kind of a person that feels, you know, we've put too much on them right now. Between you and I think they've got a heck of a mess to deal with. But are they responsible enough to deal with it? Have we created a responsible youth in our generation? Gosh. In my home, I have.
Well.
But hey.
Well, you know, no, I agree with you 100% on that.
But
I
it's
think
a
that,
tough, yeah, it's tough.
And, you know, and I don't think that's a perspective that people have really much in this argument thought about, but it's very true. You know, do we really want to give them that, you know, put that burden on them at this age? They're worried. It's funny, they grow so much between the ages of 16 and 18.
Right, they do.
You know, they change so much. They really, and they struggle with, you know, lapsing into childhood and into adulthood as they go through that transition. You know, some days you're just amazed at the things they're doing and saying. And then other days you look at them and you go, what are you, 9 years old? You
yes.
know, they go back.
Right.
It's not like one day they just open that door and walk through it. You know, they go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And I guess the good news is if you gave them the vote, they wouldn't show up because they, you know, they would, you know, they would have something more important to do, you know, or I'd love to see the rhetoric You know, the kind of conversations when they're 16 years old, they'd be texting things like, Susie said that Johnny said that, that Mary said that, that, you know, Tiffany said that I should vote for so and so, but, you know, but he's not as cute as the other guy. You know, that that would be the extent, I'm afraid, of some of their political commentary. To get to this is my new crusade in life, is to get your American citizenship. Do you still want to be a Canadian? Can't you be both? You can be both.
I just haven't done it. To be quite honest, I just haven't taken the time to do it. Would I do it? Would I carry dual citizenship? I would. Would I renounce one for the other? No, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't say, if they said you'd have to give up your Canadian citizenship, would I do that? I wouldn't. But I don't think they require that.
No, I don't think so either.
I love Canada. I was born there. It's not that I love Canada really any more than the U.S. I lived here most of my life. You know, I understand politics here in the United States far better than I do in Canada. I mean, I don't know anything about Canada anymore except for, you know, a little bit that I read now and again. It's almost a foreign country to me now, even though, you know, my heart still feels the yearning to go back to Canada, possibly when I retire, maybe.
Well, California, first of all, California is the forgotten province of Canada, right? I mean, the sunshine, you know, they're so laid back in Canada. This is my experience, you know, and I'm sure that this is a very limited experience. I've visited a few times, kind of the touristy spots like Niagara Falls and Ontario. And I spent some time in Nova Scotia, which is just, I got to tell you, one of the most beautiful places I've ever been in my entire life. And one of the reasons it's so beautiful is it's so damn cold most of the year that, you know, there hasn't been even though there's a tourist industry, there aren't those big buildings. And, you know, it's very, at least the last time I was there, it was very quaint and still very, very beautiful. You can't. In Nova Scotia, I don't ever remember being at a sight of water. If you're not looking at the Atlantic Ocean, you're looking at a lake. There's lakes all over the place. It's just an amazing place, and the people are just as nice as they can be.
Yeah.
In fact, I was stunned when my daughter recently went to Canada, and she had to have a passport. I'm like, what? Because I've been so many – it's been a while, but I've been so many times, you know, and you never needed a passport to go to Canada or Mexico, and now you need one.
Now you do. See, I didn't know that. I haven't been to Canada in, I don't know.
Oh, there you go. Decades. See, you're an American by default.
Well, exactly.
I should say you're a United Statesian by default because Canadians consider themselves Americans, North Americans as well. You don't even know the rules anymore.
That's right.
What kind of Canadian are you? But everybody else in your family?
Yeah.
Now, you didn't grow up there, or did you grow up there?
Well, when we were younger, we did. We grew up in Canada up until we were, almost 10, and we loved it. I mean, Canada was beautiful. We owned a lot of property there, ranching and so on at the time when we were really young. And the people there are just as friendly, probably the friendliest people on earth. Canadians have a heartiness and a laughter and a wit that is just really extreme. And it's beautiful. They're beautiful people. But I still have family there. I used to work there when I was, younger, up until I was in my late teens. Traveled across the border almost on a daily basis, working in downtown Vancouver on Pender Street, you know. Talking shop sort of thing. And then as I got older and things changed up, we stopped working in Canada and we were ending up exclusively working in the U.S. And I moved around a bit in the U.S., lived a little bit in Europe, also Austria. If I had my druthers really growing up, you know, the places I've been, and that's quite a few, I would have to say I still love the U.S. My heart's right here. I mean, I might not be a U.S. citizen, but my heart is really here in the United States for raising family, growing up, for the greatest government and freedoms in the world. But is that changing? Yeah, it worries me. I have four kids, you know, between the spreads of 11 and 17, one daughter and three boys, and they're all in those ages, and you know, seeing the country the way it is today worries me. But then I also look at it and see it's a very scripted stage. I mean, you look out there and it's so scripted, why would it worry you almost? I mean, it's almost like they're telegraphing everything. It's scripted. Things are kind of the way money wants it to be right now. They're giving people, you know, a lot of advance warning for most of what's going on and the politics behind it. Of course, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors and so on, to obfuscate things. But really, there's, you know, the trend's pretty easy to identify. And so far, that has kind of, to me, it's kind of given me the idea that, you know, we don't got a completely mad group of people running things. I mean, they're trying to make things look pretty chaotic on the stage. And they have, you know, machinations or designs for doing so. But I see that really that's what's going on. It's a lot of clever playing on the global stage for, let's say, power and money. It's a big land and power grab. And it's going to continue maybe for a decade. This is what I see. I know, crazy. I see there, you know, it's because it's globalizing more and this big money wants to move more out into the global situation and needs and wants to create a fair playing table for itself. A fair playing table for everybody, but really, again, it's a lot of money. It's mostly concerned for itself. So a lot of that's being pushed onto the global stage at quite an accelerated rate, and I see that continuing. I look out there and I say society's changing. You got, on the one hand, you got the people that want to stop what's going on and change the whole system and bring it all down and make it all crash. And you got the politicians want to do the same. And some of them want to go to war because there's a lot of money in it. You know, help change the system, the paradigm that way. But ultimately, everybody wants change. Even Obama, when he got on there, first thing it was change, change, change. And so I see a lot more of that coming. There's going to be more broken hearts, more fences to mend. But the changes haven't really, in my opinion, haven't even begun yet. So,
well, you know, I mean, that's a really good point. It's a really tough thing to judge, I think, because mm-hmm. I think that we see all this change around us, and I look back and I say, but haven't we always? Couldn't we have said this during the Depression, or couldn't
right.
you have said this during the Second
right.
World War?
right.
I mean, or the Civil Rights.
It always looks so grandiose to us.
Yeah,
right.
And you know, and are we having backlash? Is what's happening now in the United States what happened, for example, on maybe a more dramatic scale in the Middle East when changes came quickly, and now we've got this backlash. We've got people that like this nut that went into the abortion clinic in Colorado Springs and killed a veteran, an Iraqi veteran and a combat veteran and a mother of two. You know, we have these people that like change is coming on them. I know these people some of these people are absolutely out of their mind, but is there a sentiment that change is coming on too quickly for us somehow? And this is a reaction to it, you know.
Could be.
I don't know if you were here during the Vietnam War, but that was my political christening. I was 18 years old. I was the first group of 18-year-olds allowed to vote in the United States.
I can't remember how.
I was like eight, I think I was 19, but they just passed the 18-year-old vote. We were, we were angry about the war. We got out there, and we were making changes in society, and I saw a lot of the backlash. and the kind of thing that you're talking about, where all of a sudden, you know, I mean, I would go out, we would go out to protest sometimes, and we'd show up and there'd be 200 people and there'd be 600 cops in full riot gear. And you'd say, gee, this is kind of a overreaction to a handful of teenagers coming out and expressing their First Amendment rights. But people were upset. They didn't know what was going to happen, especially because I was here in Washington. There was this fear that there would be a student, as crazy as it is, because most of us couldn't get together on time to go watch a movie together or something. But there was this fear that we're all, you know, college students from California to Maine, we're going to come together and we're going to riot and we're going to take over the nation's capital. You know, it's just funny. But there was that sentiment, and you know, eventually things changed. And so your oldest child is 17. So
yeah, will be in a couple months, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And well, and that's a tough age. Now, where does the girl fit in?
My oldest boy will be 17 here in a couple months. Then my youngest son he'll actually be 15 on December 2nd. And then my daughter, she's just turned 13. And then I have my youngest son is 11. So they're a couple years apart. Growing up fast, as kids do.
Yeah. They grow up so fast these days, right? And it's funny, and I don't know how much you realize this with one daughter and three sons. I've got two daughters and a son, but the girls get it so much quicker. I don't know what it is.
Absolutely.
I don't know if we ever really catch up, or they just let us think that we catch up, you know? Cuz they get it so much quicker. I remember saying to my wife that, you know, one thing that amazed me is that my son would stand there. If he took his coat off and dropped it on the floor, he would stand there and argue with me for 20 minutes on why it was okay to drop his coat on the floor. Whereas my daughter, if my daughter did it and I said, hey, pick up your coat, she'd go, oh, I'm sorry, Daddy. And she would pick up the coat and walk around the corner and drop it in another room, you know, because she was smart enough to figure out, all I got to do is get rid of the coat. The old man will get off my back. He won't know the difference, you know. And there was a certain admiration for that kind of slovenly, intelligently intuitive behavior. Well, if you don't mind, I'd like to take a sip of water. So can we take a break? Play a song to start out the Christmas season, since I'm already seeing – lights everywhere and sales everywhere. We want to send this song out to America in hopes that it's a hopeful note to start the Christmas season on. So here's one from Stevie Wonder, and we'll be back in a minute.
Someday at Christmas, men won't be boys, playing with bombs like kids play with toys. One warm December, our hearts will see a world where men are free. Someday at Christmas, there'll be no wars.
Well, thank you, Stevie Wonder. Someday at Christmas. It'll all come together for us. Canadians, Americans, Mexicans, we'll all get together and hold hands, and I can't wait for that day. But, you know, this week's been a terrible, terrible week in terms of domestic violence. We had a 9-year-old shot and executed, actually, in Chicago, because a rival gang was at war with his father, a rival drug gang, and they wanted to get at his father. I think that's a new low. We had this guy walk into an abortion clinic in Colorado Springs and kill a veteran and kill a mother of two. The governor of Colorado has stepped forth and said, let's stop this rhetoric that's inflaming these people. But, I think the bottom line is we need to, in this country, we need to address the whole gun issue. And we need to address it reasonably, and we need to come together about it. I think. I don't know what you think, Don. I think personally, I'm not a gun guy. I grew up around guns, but I don't like them. Mm-hmm. But I accept the Second Amendment, and I accept the right of American citizens. I don't know about you Canadians, but American citizens to own firearms responsibly. But, you know, we got to keep them out of the hands of nuts. We can't just say anybody can have a gun, and they can have as many guns as they want, and they can have semi-automatic weapons. These guys are out there afraid of our government. And that's what a guy like this guy that went into the abortion clinic is about. He's saying this is wrong. This is a political position that I'm opposed to. And because I don't see anything being done about it, I'm going to take it into my own hands. We got to keep guns out of hands of people like that. Mm-hmm. How about California? Do you have tough gun laws in California?
You know, Between you and I, I don't own a gun. I've just never owned a gun, never needed one. I'm like you, though. I feel that people should have the right to own one. But I'm kind of mixed in all this, only because I've never owned a gun, never needed one. And that gives me a different perspective, maybe. My perspective would be, why would anybody need a handgun? The Canadians did originally. Nobody needs a handgun except law enforcement. As far as shotguns and so on, that's a different matter. If you own a shotgun or a deadly weapon like a shotgun, it's up to the states whether they want to register the people or not. Really, I think that should be a state thing. Because in Alaska, who's going to register their rifle when they're out, you know, and it's, whereas in another state, it's something different, highly populated states. So again, that should be left more up to the states. But as far as owning a handgun, I don't think anybody should own a handgun unless you're law enforcement. Now, that's my opinion. People can beat me over the head for it now if they want, but there you go.
Well, I feel the same way. And you know, I'm willing to accept some, and I'm willing to. In D.C., we have a law that if you have a compelling reason, you know, let's say I run a liquor store and most of what I get is in cash, and I have to take deposits to the bank at night after we close, and I want to pass some kind of proficiency test. I mean, I don't understand why we have to register and insure and show proficiency to drive a car, because it's potentially dangerous, but we don't have to do that for a gun. You know, a gun, at least cars are not designed to kill people. They end up killing a lot of people in the course of a year, over 40,000 nationwide. But guns are designed for the sole purpose of killing things.
Right.
And you know, why don't you have to show proficiency with it? Why don't you have to have insurance?
Like a DMV
on it?
For guns.
Why don't you register?
Right,
yeah.
Right.
You know? And then if somebody, you know, just like if somebody steals my car and runs over a pedestrian, my insurance company is responsible for that.
You just brought a hot topic up. Why not have a DMV for gun registration and then have it insurable? So
yeah,
if you do own a gun,
so
or somebody
steals
it,
my gun and kills somebody with it, the insurance company is responsible. You know, I don't understand this totally unbridled, idea that you can have any kind of gun and you don't have to have any kind of responsibility for it. I just don't get it, because we're a country of laws where people are supposed to be responsible, and you know, the law requires that we be responsible. But just because this is mentioned in the Constitution, and you know, the thing that gets me most about people that talk about the Second Amendment, most of them don't even understand it. They haven't even read it. They talk about the right to bear arms shall not be infringed, which is the end of the amendment. But the amendment starts out, the first few words of the amendment are a well-regulated militia, well-regulated militia. But for some reason, we can't regulate handguns, even though the amendment says well-regulated. I don't get it. I really don't get it. And it's one of those hot-button political issues that nobody wants to deal with. We had in the District of Columbia, to bring it back around to statehood, we had actually a law that was being considered to give a vote to our delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton, and it had passed in the House, and it was before the Senate, and we assumed it was going to pass before the Senate because we had a majority of Democrats in the Senate. But the National Rifle Association, who loves the District of Columbia, the National Rifle Association doesn't want any gun laws in the District of Columbia because they get to fight on a national platform every time they fight in the District of Columbia. They came in and said, if you support the right to give these people a vote, we will judge you harshly. The NRA, you know, they put out a record of people's voting records, and then they tell you, you know, this guy's good on guns, this guy's bad on guns. They said, we'll mark you as bad on guns if you support D.C., and a lot of people that we would have counted on, like Mark Warner, who's a somewhat liberal senator, actually an old friend of mine from Virginia, he backed out of supporting the legislation because guns are a big deal in Virginia. And no Virginia politician wants to piss off the NRA. So, you know, I don't understand why it's so sacrosanct in our society, and we're just losing too many people because of it, and we need to do something, you know. And the reason I've never had a gun, I would feel safer personally if I had a gun in my home, but I had children, and you know, and that's why I never had one, because I remember as a boy my father had a gun, and thank God it didn't work. It was a real gun, but it was an antique. And I used to find it all the time and play with it all the time. I loved playing with it when I was a kid. So I never had a gun in my house because I would have never been able, you know, if one of my kids accidentally shot themselves or somebody else, I wouldn't have been able to deal with that. So I just said, you know what? I'm going to get a big barky dog. That's my home protection system, is a 120-pound Labrador Retriever. And he works pretty well. He wouldn't attack you unless you had dog biscuits on you, but he's nonetheless a deterrent because he barks loudly.
Well, that or a cataprong.
We only have a few minutes left here, right, Don?
That's right. Well, you could always use a cataprong, you know.
A cattle prod?
A cataprong, sure. Keep one of those in the house.
I'd be afraid because Mrs. Brown might figure out how to use it. And I can see her now saying, did you unload the dishwasher? Yeah. Did you vacuum the house? You know, just the things she could get me just on the things that I promised to do and didn't do. You know, she wouldn't even have to look for, she wouldn't have to look for stuff, you know. Well, next week, I hope we have another guest. We're trying to get a guest to talk about our entry into this United Nations organization, which is very interesting. And I will report back on our meeting with the OAS tomorrow. And we'll have some exciting things I hope to talk about next week. And maybe we'll find Maria, who's out lost in the hinterland somewhere. We'll get a hold of her and get her back on track, and we'll see you all next week. Anything you want to add, Don?
Well, hope everyone had a fantastic Thanksgiving weekend, and you know, we're enjoying the final days of fall as we head into winter and Christmas time. Happy holidays, everyone. It's my favorite time of year.
Happy holidays, and let's start a campaign starting tonight. If you want Don to become an American citizen, write to BBS Radio and say, we want Don. We got half of the set. We want a match set. So write in. That'll be our new new campaign. We want Don. Well, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next week, America. Have a great week. Give the people their right to vote.